906.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NHPR observes the centennial anniversary of the Weeks Act, which created the Eastern National Forest System, including our own White Mountain National Forest. At the time, much of the forest had been clear-cut beyond recognition, and poor logging practices led to huge fires, flash floods, and waterways choked with sawdust and dirt. So in New Hampshire, the idea of creating a well-managed national forest had strong support, but on Capitol Hill it was a much harder sell, and so the task was given to Massachusetts Congressman and New Hampshire native John Wingate Weeks. Today in The Exchange, as we begin our coverage of the Weeks Act, Exchange executive producer Keith Shields offers this profile of the man who made it happen.
There isn't a whole lot written about John Wingate Weeks. He didn't keep a diary. There's one biography, published in 1928. Dartmouth's Baker Library has boxes of speeches and a few letters. But the story of the man behind the Weeks Act of 1911 has pretty much been carried down from generation to generation. John W. Weeks was 6 years old when his grandfather and namesake died.
One thing that my grandfather enjoyed immensely was chocolate candy. He was able to sit down with a box of chocolates and finish the whole thing himself. And also, he was very fond of the game of golf. He had built a small pitch and putt golf course on top of Mount Prospect in New Hampshire, and he enjoyed having guests coming up, and one of the more interesting people was President Warren G. Harding.
John Wingate Weeks was born on a farm in Lancaster, New Hampshire. He went to school until he was 16 and then left for the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. After the Navy, he had a brief stint as a land surveyor in Florida, met his wife, and moved up with her family to Massachusetts. There, he made it big as a banker. John Weeks then got involved in government. He became an alderman and mayor of Newton, Massachusetts. And then he ran for Congress and won in 1904. Once in office, he became known for his tough Granite State upbringing. Dan Weeks is a great-great-grandson.
Political cartoons would portray him carrying vats of sap through the woods during maple sugaring time. He was remembered as a larger-than-life character, and I think there was some truth to that. He had a big physical frame. We were told as kids how easy our life was because great-great-granddad used to carry an armload of wood as well as school books to heat the one-room schoolhouse.
Even though John Weeks' name is on the bill that established the Eastern National Forest, the effort started long before John Weeks was elected. Congressmen from both the North and South tried to pass forestry bills for years, but none ever came close to passing. According to Marcia Schmidt Blaine, who teaches history at Plymouth State University, it was Weeks who brought everyone together.
The Southern Appalachians effort was led by Gifford Pinchot, a leading forester and a good friend of Theodore Roosevelt's, and he absolutely did not want a White Mountain Bill because he thought it would take away from the possibility of having a national forest reserve in the Southern Appalachians. So these two groups were working against each other. What Weeks recognized was if you made it less specific, you'd broaden the support. And that's ultimately what he was able to do.
Many say that John Weeks was the right person who had the right skills at just the right time to pass this bill. He was from the White Mountains. He had an engineering background from his time in the Navy, and he was a banker and a businessman. Joseph Cannon, Speaker of the House at this time, was famous for saying that he would not pay 1 cent for scenery. Then, he gave Weeks the job of coming up with his own bill. Cannon reportedly told Weeks that if he could frame a forestry bill that businessmen would support, Cannon would bring it to the floor. And so that's what Weeks did. He focused his argument on how protecting the forest would be an economic asset for the North, the South, and the West. Once again, Plymouth State's Marcia Schmidt Blaine.
He was someone who was very pragmatic. He recognized that just protecting the forest, as important as that was not enough, that he needed to find a way to be able to preserve the White Mountains so that they would still be working forests and would still be attractive forests for tourists and would be something that could ignite people around the nation. So that's why he said, let's talk about how can we protect the watershed. That's clearly something that the national government needs to deal with. How can we control forest fires? That's clearly something that we need to deal with. So he was able to combine a number of issues together so that he organized a very successful campaign in the House of Representatives.
Finally, Weeks used his political savvy to unite a number of opposing factions under one bill. It was a political sense that his great-great-grandson Dan Weeks says we don't find as often today.
He's famous for saying, seek as much consensus as he can, not dwell on the differences, study the issues where he found he disagreed with the other side, tell his opponent frankly and the reasons why. So he had an ethic which I think was not unique to him. It defined in many ways the old New England politician. He was a Republican in the old New England tradition, which was not an ideological tradition. It was a pragmatic tradition which wanted to conserve the best of what existed and only make changes when the reasons to do so were really compelling.
John Wingate Weeks served as Massachusetts congressman until 1913 and then was elected to Senate for one term. In addition to the bill that now bears his name, Weeks helped pass the McCain-Weeks Act, a precursor to the Migratory Birds Act of 1918. He also played a role in establishing the Federal Reserve, and he was a serious candidate for the Republican presidential nomination of 1916. Weeks later served as Secretary of War for 4 years, and as Secretary, he had a stroke in 1925. He resigned from his position and died several months later. His final days were spent back at the home he built for himself on Mount Prospect in Lancaster, New Hampshire, the home that overlooks the very forest he helped save. For NHBR News, I'm Keith Shields.
And today in The Exchange, we focus in on a key guiding concept for our national forests, their status as lands of many uses. You see that language all over in the White Mountains on those iconic brown Forest Service signs. But what does it really mean? We'll explore that this hour, and let's hear from you. How do you feel about national forests as lands of many uses? Are there certain uses in the White Mountains you'd rather not see? Does everyone deserve a piece of the pie, from snowmobilers to ski areas to loggers and hikers and campers? How well does this Forest Service do in finding a balance that satisfies everyone? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in studio, Tom Wagner. He is Forest Supervisor of the White Mountain National Forest. He's been there 10 years. Tom, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dave Gavatsky, Secretary of the Weeks Act Centennial Coordinating Committee, co-author of a forthcoming book on the Eastern National Forests. And Dave also worked for the Forest Service for many years. And Dave, thanks for coming in as well.
Well, thank you, Laura, for inviting me.
Well, and Dave, I want to turn to you first. What does the Weeks Act say, if anything, about this land of many uses? Is that language even in the original bill?
No, that language is not in the initial bill. The land of many uses terminology actually came from a chief of the Forest Service by the name of Richard McArdle, who wrote in a speech in 1953 that the national forest are lands of many uses and many users.
And we see that today, for
and
sure.
We have hundreds of uses that are going on in the national forest. And just looking at winter recreation activities, and not just skiing, it's skiing in Tuckerman Ravine. It's skiing at cross-country touring centers throughout the forest and the alpine centers that we have throughout the national forest. And ice climbing, it's one of those activities that's off the radar. There's people climbing cliffs that are just covered in ice, and it's a very big activity.
So why did Mr. McArdle say in the 50s, look, we need to focus on this land of many uses? What was going on at the time, Dave, that made him feel like he needed to say that?
Well, if I can go back to 1897 when the Forest Service wasn't really even an agency, they were just looking at the Organic Act to create these national forests out west. Their initial role was for the protection of wood and water. And in the moving up into the 1940s when World War I started, there was an incredible
demand.
World War II started, and there was an incredible demand for wood products, not just for the housing effort and construction, but mainly for the military effort. Boxes and even airplanes were made out of wood. And after the war ended, World War II ended, you ended up having lots of GIs that were coming home and were looking to build homes. And where was the wood going to be coming from? And the National Forest were there with large amounts of wood in reserve. And the Forest Service increased the wood production, tripled the amount of harvesting that was going on. Building roads into areas that didn't have roads before, and focusing a lot of their effort in the Pacific Northwest, where there was a lot of old growth forest. So this became a big controversy, and the emphasis that Congress placed on the Forest Service was harvesting wood products.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. And to you, Tom, in the early years, you've got the national forests being created here in the East, and up till about, as Dave told us, World War II, things kind of move along. But then you see this huge demand for wood with the post-war boom, people building houses and the suburbs are starting to be built and so forth. And the Forest Service comes up with something called Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. Now, without getting too technical, how did that represent a realization that, whoa, we need to hold off here a little bit?
Well, I think there was a recognition that there is a finite resource that we're talking about, and that in order to use those uses over the long term, they need to be sustainable. So whether it was recreation, wood products, or watershed protection, we needed to use those things today in a way that allowed future generations to also be able to use them as well, if not better, than we are today. So there was a series of multiple laws that came out during that time that recognized that some of the values were changing in society, and so while protection of our watersheds and wood production were still important, things like recreation, wilderness, a host of other ecosystem services that we call them today would be available and are a benefit to the society as a whole.
Now, today we use the word sustainable, very often. But what about that concept in 1960, Tom? How new an idea was that to the general public that, you couldn't just do whatever you wanted for as long as you wanted to?
Well, remember, we were still developing the country as a whole. We had reached the western frontier, but we still were moving into Alaska. We had just kind of reached our frontiers of the country, and so the idea was not completely new, because John Weeks and many of the people in New Hampshire knew even in 1911 that these things could be used in a way that would not be beneficial in the future. So it was a new concept, but trying to put it to something broader than just wood, that many different values come off these public lands. They all needed to be protected.
All right. And coming up, we'll dig into this a little bit more, and we'll talk with many people who represent the different uses on the White Mountain National Forests. We'll take your calls to the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. We want your thoughts on this idea of the White Mountain National Forest as a land of many uses. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members. Support also comes to us from University of New Hampshire School of Law and its Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property, pioneering in practical legal education for New Hampshire and the world at law.unh.edu. And from Waste Management, producing enough energy to power more than 1 million homes every year. By 2020, they expect to double that output. Learn more at thinkgreen.com. More on the White Mountain National Forest, land of many uses, on the exchange on NHPR at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the role in the U.S.-Libya conflict. At 7 o'clock tonight, special coverage from NPR will be covering President Obama's speech to the nation on the situation in Libya. Again, that's tonight at 7 on NHPR. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny. Northern Coos County has a 50% chance of snow showers. Highs today ranging mid-20s in the north, lower 40s in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we focus on the land of many uses, New Hampshire's White Mountain National Forest. We're looking at just what this means, and we'd like to hear from you. How do you feel about this concept of land of many uses? Are there certain uses in the White Mountains you'd rather not see? Does everyone deserve an equal piece of the pie? And how well do you think the U.S. Forest Service does in balancing the desires of all the different users? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We go now to a group which has had a long relationship in the White Mountains. Rob Burbank is with us. He's Director of Media and Public Affairs for the Appalachian Mountain Club in Gorham. And Rob, real nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, first of all, Rob, just the AMC, how do you, as an organization devoted to outdoor recreation, interpret this concept of land of many uses?
Well, this truly is a multiple-use forest, and that's a wonderful public benefit. AMC was founded back in 1876, and our members have long been involved in exploring and protecting the White Mountains even before the National Forest. And since with the Weeks Act that you were speaking of earlier, our members were very involved in helping to lead to the passage of that legislation, and we remain very involved to this day with our members, our staff, our volunteers contributing vast amounts of energy and resources to help make mountain recreation available for folks and to help keep people informed, aware, and safe in the outdoors.
Well, and I know it's a tough balance and that AMC is involved. Every time there's a forest plan that needs to be updated, you're very much involved. If you, though, Rob, were suddenly in charge of policy for the White Mountains, what uses in this land of many uses would you get rid of, if any?
I'm not sure that I would. I mean, I think the notion of a multiple-use forest is a great way to proceed, and I think that certainly the challenge is to balance those many uses, and I think our forest managers do a great job with that, and I think a big part of that reason, is because just as there was citizen involvement that led to the passage of the Weeks Act, there continues to be strong citizen involvement in the management of the White Mountain National Forest, in the sense that when the forest plan is revised periodically, the public has an opportunity to comment, has an opportunity to say what they would like to see in the National Forest, and our forest managers really really do take that to heart and pay attention to the wishes of the public and take a look at what's happening on the land, and we have as you say, a multiple-use forest where uses such as forestry, recreation, watershed protection, certainly, wilderness protection, wildlife habitat management, all of these important public values are able to coexist.
You know, Rob, we hear from our public, our callers, that they, you know, if they're hikers, they don't like motorized use in the White Mountains. They're upset by the snowmobiles, the noise, the smell, and they don't want ATVs in the White Mountains, which I think are not allowed in the White Mountains. What about your group and its feelings about motorized travel recreation in the White Mountains?
Well, AMC, by its nature, is focused on muscle-powered recreation. We recognize the importance of snowmobiling to New Hampshire and certainly believe that, with appropriate public input, planning, and management, that use can coexist with other uses. But for our part, we are focused on muscle-powered recreation, so we concentrate our efforts on helping to provide recreational opportunities such as hiking, paddling, cross-country skiing. And we also focus on maintaining a network of more than 350 miles of hiking trail in New Hampshire. And I should note that all of that is open to use by the public. And at the same time, we're working to protect natural resources through thoughtful trail management. And that helps to manage use while also minimizing erosion. So we continue to be quite active in helping to manage use in the White Mountains.
Yeah, it sounds good on paper, you know, Rob, but what if you are looking forward to a nice, quiet experience and all of a sudden there's a gang of snowmobiles or, you know, dirt bikes or whatever? Again, I don't think dirt bikes are allowed, but, you know, it's hard to balance it sometimes. Some people seek peace and quiet in the White Mountains.
Well, it is tough to balance a variety of uses. And I think if people are going to go out and use the National Forest, there are certain places more appropriate for certain uses than others, and you just need to give that some thought before you head out. But I do think that various user groups are working well together,
mm-hmm.
and I do think that there is a recognition that there are a variety of uses on the forest.
How much do you think your average hiker, not someone perhaps who is from New Hampshire, especially northern New Hampshire, but your average person who comes up, you know, for the week from Boston or Hartford, how much do you think they appreciate or understand the difference between a national forest and a national park? Again, you know, national forest being land of many uses.
Well, I think in general terms, a lot of folks aren't necessarily clear on the differences between how a national park is managed or how a national forest is managed. But I think when people come up to the White Mountain National Forest and they have the opportunity to have some wonderful recreational experiences, it's not so much that isn't quite the important thing is that they're able to do that. And I do think that when folks do learn that there are a variety of uses that do take place side by side here in the National Forest, I do think it is somewhat eye-opening, because it's such a wonderful place for outdoor recreation, as you know, certainly as we know just by the popularity of this forest.
Absolutely. Well, Rob, thank you very much for being with us. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. Great to be with you.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Rob Burbank, Director of Media and Public Affairs for the Appalachian Mountain Club in Gorham. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go to another call out to another interest group, Tom Wagner, again, Forest Supervisor of the White Mountain National Forest, I did want to just ask you, what is the Forest Service policy in terms of motorized recreation in the White Mountains?
Well, in the White Mountains specifically, there are about 400 miles of snowmobile trails that in the wintertime do allow for ATV use. We don't get a lot of ATV use on the snowmobile trails, but they're open to motorized in the wintertime. In the summertime, we do not have a motorized component to our trail systems, and that was a decision that was made in the forest plan related to the amount of heavy use we already have on the forest in recreation. The ability to manage motorized use in our topography and soil types, and the overall feedback we got from the public on the existing use of the forest. So that was a hard decision we made.
What was hard about it?
The hard is that you have people that are very good, responsible ATV riders, and they were hoping that we would open up additional trails for their use. Other places in the state, like Jericho State Park, have been conducive to providing that use, and it is it is a legitimate recreational pursuit. We just didn't think, based on the heavy use we have in the topography of the forest, that the White Mountain was the best place for it.
And Dave, you're our historian. When did this issue first start bubbling up, whether to allow ATVs in the White Mountain National Forest?
Well, the issue over motorized use on the National Forest, if you can go back into the late 60s and the 70s when the snowmobile became much more commonly available. It's a totally different machine than we have out there today. In the early 70s, these very small, very light, and very capable machines were traveling all over the forest, and this became a major concern for the managers, concerns that people were going in places where they shouldn't have been, they were getting stuck, injuries and that.
And wildlife?
And disturbance to wildlife, the noise factor was a considerable thing, and just actually making these packed trails that coyotes could move in and go after deer and that. So there's multiple considerations, this complex topic. And as the years went on, the three-wheelers came out, the ATVs, and fairly rapidly replaced by four-wheelers. Lots of public concerns, even among the snowmobile community, about allowing these machines on snowmobile trails, because they thought that they would lose the right to even have snowmobile use on the trail. So
we've been talking about this since the 60s then.
60s and 70s, yes, that's correct.
And how satisfying do you think the resolution that we have now is? Yes, snowmobiles, yes, ATVs in the winter, no motorized travel in the summer. Do you think most people are satisfied with that?
I think most people are satisfied. You know, it took an effort of compromise, and now that we have a state agency, the State Trails Bureau, that really works closely with the snowmobile clubs and to maintain the trails and provide a really nice experience for snowmobilers to travel throughout the state, and the 400 miles of trail that Tom mentioned that are on the National Forest, that we have a good compromise.
All right. Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in the exchange, we're looking at the White Mountain National Forest and its status as a land of many uses. How well do you think the Forest Service does in balancing all these different uses that we've been talking about? How do you think the idea of land of many uses could be updated? And are there uses in the White Mountains that you would rather not see? 1-800-892-6477, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, another huge use, of course, in the White Mountain National Forest is timber harvesting. And for more on that is Jason Stock, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association. Hi, Jason. Thanks for waiting, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good morning.
Just to set the stage for us, if you could, Jason, how much of the White Mountain National Forest is open to logging right now?
Well, the volume of acreage, and Tom may be able to put the exact numbers on it. It depends on how they more or less zone it. It's, I believe, the areas that are open to what they call 2.1 lands is around 45, just under half, I believe, is the 2.1 lands. And those are lands that are open to, that are possible timber harvesting locations. And then certainly within those lands, there are portions of them that, you know, are inaccessible. So Tom could probably give you a more exact figure after they, considering the inventories that they've done out there.
The number I've come across, Jason and Tom, is about a third of the White Mountain National Forest is open to logging. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's correct, Lord. Jason's also right. That's just because there are areas that are either too steep, the soil conditions are not conducive to forestry. So 35% on a realistic basis.
And Jason, to you, do your members of the Timberland Owners Association, do they feel like that's enough, 35%?
You know, we were very active participants in the last planning process, and we would have liked to have seen more, but we are satisfied with the 35%. And we, you know, there was a real spirit of cooperation when the planning process came about, and we made concessions, and there were some areas that were taken out of timber consideration for timber production that, yes, we would have liked to have seen them remain. But we also recognize that as the land of, you know, many uses, our uses had to be balanced with others. And so the short answer is, yes, we would have liked to have seen more, but we also recognize that with the other uses going on out there, that we did make some concessions and recognize that there are folks out there who would rather not see trees harvested and areas set aside for other uses, and we were willing to make that concession.
You know, given that recreation is the dominant use of the White Mountains today, Jason, how does your group in this planning process make the case that logging still has a place in the White Mountains?
Sure. Basically, on two points. One is, you know, logging not only produces logs for sawmills and pulpwood for paper mills, but it also is a really important component of the wildlife program on the White Mountain National Forest. And so, you know, recreation, a big part of recreation is wildlife viewing and looking for, you know, going out and looking at different birds, looking for different bird species and different, you know, things like moose and deer. And to attract those to to any forest, you need a variety of age classes with timber stands and a variety of trees. And the best, probably the most effective way to get that is through timber harvesting and doing sustainable management. So I think, you know, on that point, timber harvesting really dovetails well with many of the goals and objectives in the plan as they relate to forestry and forest management. The other thing that folks sometimes forget is that many of the trails and many of the recreational areas that are in place being used now for hiking or snowmobiling, those are former or even still current logging trails and access points. And
I've hiked on those myself, Jason.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of counterintuitive, though. I mean, lots of folks might think timber harvesting wasn't good for wildlife, but you're saying it is because it provides wildlife with a variety of ages in terms of the trees.
Exactly.
And they need that.
Exactly. And that's what the wildlife biologist will tell you. And, you know, as a state, New Hampshire's forests are getting older. I just looked at some recent data. Statewide, our forests are getting older. And so there are a lot of bird and animal species that need those younger trees, those saplings, the brambles that come, you know, that can only grow in open field type areas. And the way to get those is to go in and do timber management.
You know, Jason, you said earlier that, yes, your members would have liked to have had more land open to logging, but you realized it's a land of many uses. You need to compromise. Where is the resistance coming from for less logging, and has that resistance grown in recent years or leveled off?
I there's a resistance out there. I think I don't know if it's grown, but there's certainly a portion of the population that just philosophically is opposed to harvesting trees, particularly trees on public lands. And no matter how much data or science you can show that talks about things like wildlife habitat management and the creation of recreational opportunities, there's just a, you know, it's just a philosophical divide. And so we see that quite regularly, particularly when you look at the plan and you look at timber harvesting in areas that perhaps haven't seen management in 20, 30 years.
People get used to it being
exactly. And it's something new and something different.
Jason, we are going to talk more specifically about logging in the Whites on Wednesday. And I know you'll be joining us in studio for that. So I'll wrap up with you now, Jason, but I'll see you on Wednesday.
Hey, I look forward to it.
All right, thanks. Jason Stock, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association. And Tom Wagner, Dave Gavatz, let's go to the phones now. And Randy's calling in from Brookline. Hi, Randy. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
My question was the Northern Pass Power Line project, as it's currently proposed, is going through some numerous miles of national forest, and I was just wondering what the opinion of your guest this morning is regarding that.
Yeah, Randy, thanks a lot for calling in. And I'll reference you also, Randy, to a program we did, gosh, about a month ago now on that. You can go to our archives and check it out. Tom Wagner, what's the Forest Service involvement, if any, at this moment with the Northern Pass project?
Well, Laura, we're a cooperating agency with Department of Energy to study that proposal. It's a proposal at this point, 10-mile proposal that would come through parallel to Highway 93 in the Kinsman Notch.
So it would go through part of the White Mountains.
That's what the proposal is, and that we have a power line that Public Service in New Hampshire has a right-of-way and a special use permit for a power line in that area now. We will be looking at the interest, the public interest, to have additional power lines. We will also be seeing if that's the best location and working through the environmental impact statement. Our position is we'll be listening to the public and looking at what the effects on the ground are.
Right. Well, and Dave, I can't ask you now, but I will ask you in a few minutes. This is part of the history of the national forests. It hasn't just been timber and recreation. Hydropower, other uses like that have also come up in the past. We'll talk about that after a short break and take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Tickets are on sale now for Live at the Loft. This live concert broadcast series is the latest collaboration between NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. We have a great roster of musicians lined up for this new series, including Buffalo Tom and Patty Larkin. Visit nhpr.org to get tickets and more information. And join me, Bob Lord, Saturdays in April in concert at the Loft or live on NHPR.
Made possible in part by People's United Bank.
Support for NHPR comes from You Are Members and from IamCollegeBound.org, providing resources to inspire New Hampshire high school students to pursue higher education. Information online at IamCollegeBound.org. And Vintage Kitchens of Concord, supporting the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance's online auction of gifts, tours, getaways, and historic preservation services through April 10th. NHPreservation.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the White Mountain National Forest and its status as a land of many uses. It's part of NHPR's focus this week on the Weeks Act, the centennial anniversary of the act that created our system of eastern national forests. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Let's get your thoughts about this concept of the land of many uses and how hard or easy it is to find a balance that satisfies everyone. 1-800-892-6477. Is our number, our email exchange at nhpr.org. And before we go back to our phones, Dave Gavatsky, I did want to ask you to respond also to Randy's call, who called earlier. Beyond what Tom told us about, you know, working with the Department of Energy, environmental impact statements, approvals and so forth, what's the sort of legal or philosophical ideas around a project like Northern Pass? And does it fall under this concept of land of many uses?
Well, it was a good question, and there's been a history of similar type conflicts over uses. And the question is always how much of one particular type of use over the other. Let me go back to the year 1927 when the Forest Service proposed putting a forest fire lookout tower on Mount Shikorwa, an icon of New Hampshire, you know, just a wonderful place. Now, here's the Weeks Act in 1911 allowing for the purchase of public land for protecting the watersheds. And one of the parts of the Weeks Act was for cooperative forest fire protection. And fire towers are certainly part of that. Now, here the Forest Service wants to put this tower up on this wonderful mountaintop, Bear Mountaintop, which in fact had burned over years before. And the groups like the Appalachian Mountain Club and the Society for Protection of New Hampshire Forest and others said, no, wait a minute. You know, we really need to consider the impacts of what's going on here. And by working together, which has been characteristic through this century, that they were able to convince the Forest Service, well, let's move it to this mountain called Middle Sister. And in fact, they raised $1,000 and came up with this architect who designed a really beautiful stone lookout tower that blended in with the scenery. And we can only hope, because the public is so interested and so concerned about Northern Pass and as it goes through the White Mountains and northern New Hampshire, that we can come up with something that will fit the needs of the public and the demands that are out there. But
well, you know, when you look at this land of many uses, and I've gone through a lot of Forest Service documents, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is what we've been talking about, recreation, snowmobiling, logging. But in other national forests, this issue of electricity transmission has come up.
Oh, it certainly has.
It's one of the uses. We just don't talk about it very much.
And the guiding principle of the Forest Service has always been, you know, way back in 1905, was the greatest good for the greatest number over the long term. But the question is, who decides? And what's it going to be in 15 years? And we really don't know what that's going to be.
Highly subjective question,
that's
isn't
right.
it? Greatest good. All right. We will take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. I want to go now to another group that has also had a long interest in the future of the White Mountain National Forest. Joining us now is Catherine Corkery. She's director of the New Hampshire chapter of the Sierra Club. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
Well, about 10 years ago, Catherine, in the late 1990s, the Sierra Club pushed to make the White Mountain National Forest the White Mountain National Park instead. Why, Catherine, and what happened to that effort?
Well, I think what we were, our main issue was to focus on the preservation part of the land of many uses. And we felt at that time that there could be more ability to have to expand preservation in the forest by switching it over to a national park, and I think we worked on that for a little while, and it does predate me,
right?
But I think what that turned into actually was to focus on the roadless areas in the national forest.
So you decided, okay, let's not go whole hog and go for a national park, but focus on expanding preservation.
Right, exactly. And the roadless rule, it's interesting you were just talking about, you know, who decides.
Right.
The roadless rule was unprecedented in that the administration actually went across the country and asked people for their comments about what they feel and how they feel about the forest and expanding roads in the forest. And the roadless rule would have prevented new roads from expanding into areas that were obviously did not have roads in them and that were seen to have certain characteristics that were almost Big W wilderness, but not quite Big W wilderness. And the roadless rule had an unprecedented support across the country. 98% of all the comments across the country were in support of preserving the roadless areas.
Again, these would be roads for logging. And this came at the end of the Clinton administration, right?
That's right. That's right. And we also had public hearings here in the White Mountains, And again, the comments were in support of the roadless areas.
Well, Catherine, we're going to talk more specifically about logging in the whites on Wednesday, and I know someone from your group is going to be joining us then. So I want to put aside the roadless wool for just a moment and ask you more broadly, if there were any uses in this land of many uses that you could wave your magic wand and get rid of, would you?
Well, I think my wand has already worked. we don't have motorized vehicles aside from the snowmobiles, and I think that's a really important piece for the Sierra Club nationally and here in New Hampshire. I think the wilderness is the part that I think is actually more and more important. As we see development in the Northeast and all around the country expand, national forests become that much more important because there are fewer and fewer places like them in our neighborhoods.
So if you had your druthers, you'd like to see the wilderness areas expanded. Capital
yes.
W wilderness.
Capital W wildernesses.
All right. Catherine, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again or someone else from the Sierra Club later this week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Catherine Corkery, director of the New Hampshire chapter of the Sierra Club. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And I want to go to another person with a strong interest in the White Mountain National Forest management, land of many uses. We talk now with Terry Callum. He's president of the New Hampshire Snowmobile Association. Terry, good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning.
We've been talking about the different uses of the White Mountains, land of many uses. Roughly how much, Terry, is the White Mountain National Forest open to snowmobiling?
We definitely have a significant trail system that travels throughout the White Mountain National Forest, but I believe it's probably around 300 miles of trails within the National Forest. It does, certainly we have access.
And that sounds like a lot, but is it really enough?
Well, it's a large area of land in the state. Throughout the state, we've got 7,000 miles plus of accessible snowmobile trails. So it is not the significant majority, but it is obviously, in many cases, extremely good trail with extremely good views and excellent terrain and oftentimes deep snow.
And we've talked earlier in the conversation, and you probably heard, Terry, that, you know, the rap against snowmobiles that's come up over the years is the noise disturbs wildlife, the tailpipe emissions pollute the air. When you sit down as part of the forest planning process, what do you and members of your club say when you're criticized as a use that is not in step with wise management of the resource?
Well, I think we disagree that we aren't in step, and I think we acknowledge that, you know, we're a motorized recreation, but at the end of the day, our usage levels, are reasonable. We have machines that are continually getting better when it comes to things like you described emissions. Machines today have to meet EPA standards. There was new standards that evolved in 2006, 2010, and 2012. And so, older machines may not need to meet those standards, but the sport is consistently getting better and better, and the clubs do a phenomenal job of working with all land owners, whether it be private or public landowners, to try to make sure our trail systems, benefit the rider, but also make the impacts as reasonable as possible.
Well, and those trails sometimes used by cross-country skiers and winter hikers and so forth. Terry, just one last quick question for you. How satisfied are you with the balance that we have today in terms of balancing, again, the desires of all these many users?
I think we're reasonably happy with what we have for a balance. I think we have access to areas that we need, we are part of the discussions whenever the rule discussions come up.
Okay. Terry, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
No problem.
Terry Callum, president of the New Hampshire Snowmobilers Association. And Tom Wagner, Dave Gavotsky, let's go right back to our callers. The number 1-800-892-NHPR. Aaron's waiting in Alton Bay. Aaron, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. No problem, Laura. Certainly appreciate the show. It's great. I know you guys have covered a lot of topics, and I wish Terry was still around. I just am curious, you know, what is the most often used excuses for snowmobiling and ATV motorized use in these used lands?
Well, and how do you feel about it, Aaron?
Well, I must clarify that I am probably biased more toward no ATV and no use, because there's one thing that I definitely don't think you can get around, and that's the noise factor. And, you know, I mean, I hear you guys have said it frequently in the show so far, the land of many uses is the greatest good for the greatest many. And so I'm just curious how much of a force politically is the snowmobile clubs and the ATV users, and you know, how much more in the, you guys have talked about the past, how much more in the future are we going to see, you know, this kind of battle go on between more use or less use?
We've seen it in this debate in other national forests and national parks as well, with the snowmobiling in Yellowstone.
Yeah, I mean, they've been successful in the Adirondacks, I think,
all right,
of keeping them out as well. So,
well, Aaron, anyway, in the interest of time, I'm going to wrap you up, and it's a great question, and Tom Wagner, I'll throw it to you. What are the most frequent arguments given, in his words, for the use of motorized vehicles in the Whites?
Well, again, it's a recreational pursuit that allows people to see some of the great views, the backcountry, to observe nature close up. And so we've tried to balance that by having areas that were zoned to have more motorized use. That was part of the planning process. And then any time we look at an additional trail or a connection to the existing system, we're required to do an additional public outreach. And we look at things relative to the decibel levels of the use and the actual air quality effects. And so those are things that we engage the public with. I think the other thing that Terry and Dave mentioned earlier on is that the clubs have done a lot of work, not just with public landowners, but with private landowners, to respond to concerns. And we do see many of our trails get used by multiple user groups and them respecting each other's, you know, right to be there. So it's not a great controversial issue. We have a limited number that we say in the forest plan that we would look at for any additional trails, recognizing that we have many trails already on the forest.
And Dave Gavatsky, you talked a couple minutes ago about this long debate since the 1960s of motorized use in the White Mountains. But I like Aaron's second question. How do you think this debate will play out in the future?
I think there's going to be a lot of discussion over just what we have for resources, you know, even gasoline supplies in 50 years. We really don't know. But getting back to the snowmobile question, the snowmobiles are much quieter, much cleaner burning. We used to, you know, be concerned just about the smell, the blue fumes that would be coming out of them. And now with the four-stroke engines that they're using, very quiet, and we don't see as many problems. I mean, you can even take cross-country skiers that are applying a Teflon base wax on their cross-country skis, and there's a certain amount of impact to the environment from this Teflon going into the water supplies that, you know, we don't discuss. But one of the other motorized issues that we have, and it's one of the most popular uses on this national forest, is driving for pleasure. You know, we haven't spoken about that. One of the greatest uses is driving the Kankamaugus Highway and all
big
of these
tour
other
buses, yeah, motorcycles, cars,
and it's a,
right,
a huge economic engine for our state, and rooms and meals taxes, and all of these other issues. And so the Forest Service often gets between a rock and a hard spot. They're in the middle, and they're trying to, you know, figure out what kind of use should go where, how much is always the big question, and how is it going to impact the environment. And it's a very complex job because nothing is ever really simple. Park Service has a much easier job. You know, they're managing for the preservation of scenic beauty and these historic sites. The Fish and Wildlife Service is managing for wildlife. The Forest Service has multiple things to do. And
now, we don't envy Tom his job, do we, Dave? You know, Tom, Dave, I'm so glad you raised that. We don't think about those buses and cars and motorcycles that are on the paved roads. Has there been any talk, Tom, in recent years about those giant tour buses not idling anymore at popular spots? Because that's been a focus, I know, and with all the focus on climate change, people have said school buses, please don't idle. And you certainly do. Sometimes people complain about snowmobiles. Sometimes you get out at some of these popular spots in the White Mountains and the tour buses kind of stink.
Yeah, we've actually tried to redesign here in the last 10 years some of our parking areas and things so that they can accommodate those buses safely, and so the bus can be shut down when the people are enjoying the site.
Do you have a rule? Shut down while your folks are taking their pictures?
I'm not sure there is an actual rule on that. I think one of the interesting things we are working on is we're working on with a number of groups, including the State Department of Transportation, is looking at alternative transportation methods for the white, that somebody could come get a room in Lincoln and not have to drive their car or other mode of transportation. And we're basically at the study phase with the Department of Energy funds on that right now. But looking at other ways to think about what would it be like if 25 years from now we double the number of cars coming up the Kank, and are there alternative transportation systems that we could be considering with other user groups?
Interesting. So as this recreational component just continues to grow, can we accommodate all those additional cars? Do we need to think about something else? I know that that's been in the national parks. I think they've started to say, no, you can't bring your car. You have to take our tour buses.
That's correct. And the white would be one of the first Forest Service units in the country to at least study whether there's a possibility to have it be economically feasible and also reduce our carbon footprint as we did it.
Real interesting. Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. Gentlemen, thank you so much for making the trip down here. I know it was a long one. I really appreciate it. Tom Wagner, thank you for being here.
Appreciate it.
Tom Wagner, Forest Supervisor of the White Mountain National Forest, and Dave Govatsky, thank you also for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Dave Govatsky, Secretary of the WEEKSAC Centennial Coordinating Committee, co-author of a forthcoming book on the Eastern National Forests. And coming up all week, we'll be focusing more on the WEEKSAC. Tomorrow night and Wednesday morning, Amy Quinton will have a report on this land of many uses concept. And on Wednesday, we'll look more closely at the issue of logging in the whites, including the roadless rule that the Sierra Club mentioned. All that coming up, so stay with us. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. The Exchange celebrates its 15th anniversary season with support from Bank of America, committed to serving New Hampshire's communities.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our 15th anniversary series, The Exchange Yearbook, continues with the year 1998 and a look at the North Country. Over the past decade and a half, much of New Hampshire has flourished, but the North Country's had a different story, an exodus of residents, paper mills closing, and the economy suffering. And yet the last few years have seen new ideas and new hopes as well. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.